We're happy to make podcasts available for selected EdWebinars for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Lynn Scott, Senior Program Director with EdWeb, and we're honored to host interviews with recipients of the Congressional Medal of Honor and bring them to educators and classrooms across the country so that students can learn about the qualities of courage and sacrifice and how these qualities relate to their own lives. Today, our guest is Kyle White, who received a Congressional Medal of Honor for his actions and service in Afghanistan. He's joined by Kathy Ehlers-Metcalf, the Vice President of Education for the Congressional Medal of Honor Foundation. Before we begin, we'd like to find out who's joined us today. So we're going to conduct a short poll. Teachers, tell us what grade levels you teach, and if you're viewing today's presentation with your class, what grade levels is your class with? If you aren't represented in the poll options, you can tell us about yourself in the chat box on the left of your screen. So we have a very nice distribution of students and teachers with us today, some of them from the elementary schools, and then also from the middle and high schools, with a predominance of students and teachers from the elementary grades. We also have a nice selection of folks from other areas, and nice to have a good assortment of people with us today. We're going to close that poll now, and we want to thank you for letting us know who's with us today. And at this time, I'm going to drop off so that Kathy and Kyle can begin their presentation. We appreciate all of your attending today.
Thank you, Lynn, and hello, viewers from all over the country. It's nice to have you with us today. We're here in Charlotte, North Carolina, where Kyle and his family currently live. And Kyle, thank you so much for joining us today. A little background for those of you who are viewing. The purpose of these webinars really is very much to give all of you, students in particular, an opportunity to talk with Kyle and ask him questions in a manner that you are not going to have an opportunity to do. We only have 71 Living Medal of Honor recipients, and so this is a pretty rare opportunity. And so when I take questions, the first questions I'm going to take will be student questions as much as possible. And some of you sent in student questions ahead of time. We will filter those in along with the ones with the class who's with us today. We want to say thank you to Mr. Dennert's class from Royal High School in California, my class. And you guys can smile and say hi, it's okay. Relax. And also thank you to Mrs. Courtney Straka, who's there with them as well. So we have teachers, students all over the place. We do screen the questions, and you are welcome to, those of you who are watching and are not on the screen with us, are welcome to type in questions. Work with your teachers for that, and we'll get to as many questions as we can today. On the poll, I see we have a lot of elementary students with us today, which is a whole lot of fun. That doesn't happen very often. I would like to trust that those of you who are watching with classes have already gone over Kyle's Medal of Honor action, because our focus today is not going to be specifically on the war, although as much as Kyle, as you would like to talk about it, you are welcome to. But I would hope that you're prepared. Kyle's action was mainly a defensive action in saving the lives of his comrades who were with him that day, and calling in rescue as well, as I understand it. So would you give the students a little background about what got you into the military and why you wanted to serve this country?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up pretty regular. I grew up in Seattle, Washington, enjoyed doing everything outdoors. I kind of always had a little pull towards serving my country. My father had served and my grandfather as well. And so it was in high school that I knew, okay, this is what I want to do with my life. And I think it was about 6 months before, graduating high school, I was like, okay, I'm going to join the Marine Corps. And you know, I went to the recruiting office, you know, got all the information and got ready to, you know, tell my parents my plan. And when I did, you know, my dad was Army and he was Special Forces, like kind of at the tail end of Vietnam. And, you know, he had a very, you know, stern way of telling me that I'm not going to be a Marine. And so and I say stern because there's kids watching. But and so he's like, you know, if you want to join, you want to serve your country, you're going to do it in the Army. And so I had a very small, really, you know, requirement. I wanted to carry a rifle and I wanted to be on the front lines. And the Army told me, hey, you can be airborne infantry and you can jump out of a perfectly good airplane. And I was like, sure, let's do it.
It strikes me from what little I've seen about your growing up years that you were kind of destined for that kind of activity, because what kinds of things did you like to do when you were a kid?
Pretty much anything non-traditional. So when I say that is, I wasn't really involved in any school sports or anything. I kind of gave, you know, the you know, I guess you'd say the college try in middle school with all the sports, but really, it was motocross, riding mountain bikes, you know, hunting, fishing, stuff like that. It's what I spent my time doing.
Those strike me as the kinds of things that would indicate you were headed toward being a Ranger. The yes. High risk stuff. And
something like that.
Yeah. Exciting. Lots yeah. of thrills.
Exactly.
Okay. Did you expect to get thrills when you went into the service and had the opportunity to jump out of, as you said, perfectly good airplanes?
Yeah. So I would say, even although I came from a family of service, I was still very naive about what to expect. And all that kind of came crashing down, you know, as soon as you get, and we've all seen the movies where, you know, you show up for boot camp and all the drill instructors are screaming at you. Well, it's definitely far more significant in person. And that was the first time I was kind of like, okay, well, I think I don't know what I'm going to expect at all now. So it was interesting.
So I bet your dad's version of stern paled considerably next to the drill sergeant's version
yes.
of stern.
Yes, their vocabulary is limited, but they use it well.
Convincing?
Yes.
Okay. All right. We are going to go to for back and forth for questions between what I have written down as questions and also what the students have as questions. Has anybody got one out there at Royal High School that you would like to offer us at this point?
Yeah, so hi, my name is Tristan. You shared that one of your goals is to make sure people you served with are recognized for their actions. Can you briefly tell us about a comrade who you think deserves to be recognized?
Yeah, well, really, it's all of them. So on the ambush that day, on our ambush that day, there were 6 U.S. service members that were killed. And through our deployment, a total of 15 members of our unit were killed in that that entire deployment. One that really sticks out to me is Sean Langevin. He was my best friend up until, you know, that point. I'd say it's always kind of been a tough point to think about. Him being killed in action, because if you go to like U.S. Army's website, you can actually go through what's called a battlescape, and it will list out, you know, start to finish everything that happened during the ambush. And so during that ambush, you know, we were separated into 2 different positions. And so if you go on there, you can really read about his story, but just him as a person, he was definitely like one of the best of us. And, you know, I miss him every day. And definitely, you know, his sacrifice deserves to be recognized.
Did you meet him in the service or did you join together?
I did. So actually we had gotten to, obviously we went to basic training at the same place, Fort Benning, Georgia, and he actually arrived to the unit about 2 weeks ahead of me. So he was the graduating class before me in boot camp. And, you know, we were in the same team, same unit ever since then. And yeah, it was just kind of one of those people that even if he was doing something to kind of annoy you, and he was very good at doing that, you know, he was kind of, you know, the more of the clown out of our platoon, but he was somebody that you can just help but like and hang out with. So
I'm sure there's an important place for levity in these circumstances.
There is.
Good to be able to laugh in spite of the circumstances. So you, What year did you graduate from high school?
2005.
And your Medal of Honor action was 2007.
It was.
You were pretty darn young.
Yeah, so I actually got to my unit in August of 2006, and we deployed May of 2007, and the data action was 9 November 2007. So definitely, you know, just had a little bit over a year of service at that point.
So I point that out to boys and girls, first of all, because while Kyle is still very young, he was actually a lot closer to your age at the time of his action. You were young not only as a human being, but also young as a serviceman as well. Mm-hmm. Some of one of the students who wrote in ahead of time asked how your training helped you react under fire in Afghanistan when you were ambushed.
Yeah, so that's actually a great question. And really, my training, I credit solely for the outcome of that day being what it was. And, you know, one of my non-commissioned officers, which is like, you know, the enlisted guy who basically tells us all what to do, our platoon sergeant, he, I talk to him often, and I always tell him really one of the reasons why that day turned out what it was is because, you know, how hard you were on us and how strict you were with the training. And it's because, you know, they kind of ingrained, you know, through repetition, through scenarios, you know, through wargaming, that we were able to understand, okay, things can go very bad. And in this situation, what would you do? And really, I feel like it was the fact that we were trained on not only our own job, but the job of the people to the left and right of us. That's, you know, kind of what he taught us. You need to know all of these things. And really, is crazy as that day was, the exact people to my left and right were the jobs that I had to step in and fill. And so really, anytime I talk to the leadership from that deployment, I'm like, you know, the only reason why we got through that day is because we knew how to work as a team. We were trained and we did our jobs.
And that leader was not with you that day. He was not with you the day that you of your ambush, right?
He wasn't. So we were
that was on, who trained you
yeah,
back during basic
we were
training.
We were moving back to him. So he was back at our base.
Okay. And so who was in charge at the time that the ambush hit?
The leader in charge of the actual patrol itself was Lieutenant Ferrara, who was posthumously promoted to captain. So he was killed in action that day as well.
Okay. And you were the radio telephone operator?
Yes. I was his radio telephone operator, which, you know, the Army loves acronyms and there's one for everything. So I'll try to break them down. And if for some reason I messed one up, I apologize. But the radio telephone operator, basically their primary job is to relay communication from the person in charge on the ground. So that's simple things like where we are. And, you know, the running joke is officers never know where they are. So they always ask us, but, you know, anyways, and just overall, like the status of the patrol and what happens. And obviously in the event that, you know, we are having contact with the enemy, we relay situation reports and help make sure everything's controlled.
And called in for relief and evacuation eventually as well.
Yes. That was a part of that day. And again, you know, obviously we're a little constrained on time. I'd love to go into all the details, but really if you go on that Army's website, it's actually pretty cool. That battlescape, you can, you know, get everybody's point of view from people over there. And it's a pretty interesting.
That's pretty amazing. This is the first I've heard of that. And so it's open to the public. It's through, is it usarmy.mil?
Yes.
Okay. There you go, boys and girls. Make note of that, usarmy.mil. I was talking about primary sources. There's an opportunity to go look at that source.
I was almost going to say, you know, get on your phones now, but I don't think your teachers would appreciate that.
No, so. Neither would I. So we need to keep all the bandwidth focused here. So don't do that right now, but do that afterwards. Another question that a student asked was, what motivated you to keep going and treating your fellow comrades throughout the firefight? One of the things that we haven't mentioned thus far is that you really ended up almost acting as a medic as well, though you were not trained as a medic. Is that true?
So, yeah, that's another great question. And really what it came down to is the fact that, you know, I'm going to try to explain it the best I can because it's almost indescribable, the bond that you form to the people that you deploy with. But, you know, you start off, you get to the unit, it's kind of like getting to, you know, the first day of classes, and it's just, you don't know anybody and it's uncomfortable. But after, you know, you're seeing nothing but those people around you, you know, 24/7 for a year, you know, 14 months, whatever it may be, you know, they really become more than the people you serve with. They become members of your family. And so when it came time to decide, you know, what are my actions going to be? You know, this guy to my left is wounded. The guy to my right is wounded. What am I going to do? It really wasn't much of a decision-making process because I know in that moment, if I was the guy who was wounded out on that trail, exposed to fire, that, you know, my brothers next to me would do whatever they could to help me out. And yes, you know, we are all have, you know, I guess first responder training is what you associated with. So how to, you know, dress and treat casualties on the battlefield. And really when, you know, you're the only able-bodied person at a location and you have a bunch of wounded guys, you know, your primary mission as being an infantryman kind of subsides and you got to worry, hey, I'm going to do what I have to get these guys out of here.
Key phrases, students, to listen to: do what you have to get the job done. You mentioned, we've talked about you a little about you being the radio telephone operator and the bond you formed with your peers there on the battlefield. And you mentioned they're like family, but somebody asked, how difficult was communication back home to your family during the time you were serving?
Yeah. So this was, you know, 2007, 2008, and we were in a pretty remote part of Afghanistan. So a lot of our communication was through, you know, satellite link telephones and stuff like that. I'd say for the most part, communication was very good the last part of our deployment because we were more consolidated on a larger base. But I know, you know, we're out there near the ambush site and stuff like that at a couple of the bases around that location. I mean, there'd be a few weeks where you wouldn't be able to get any messages in or out just because technology wasn't at the point it is today back then. So,
and I would point out to students to keep that in perspective. The technology was not what it is today, but the technology then was much more than many of Kyle's Medal of Honor brothers from Vietnam who only had telephones. And then if you go back before that to Korea and World War II, they only could write letters home and it would be weeks before anybody got news one way or the other, even from the Army. If they sent telegrams, oftentimes it was weeks before that communication got through. So that's something to consider, to look at from both a technological perspective and also from a political perspective of what we do and don't know about what's going on the field. Could we take some more questions from Royal High School? If I've got some students who are ready to go with questions, we'd like to hear what you have to ask.
Hi, my name is Michaela. And my question is, if you have a mentor, maybe another recipient that has helped you since receiving the Medal of Honor, who is it?
Yeah, so I've actually had quite a few mentors over the years, especially since being a recipient. But I'd say a lot of, really over, especially the past 2 years, it's been kind of working with all of them. And even with the newer generation, so I say newer generation, but the guys from post 9/11, you know, we have a little bit, you know, more in common with some of the guys from the other conflicts, just, you know, age and also type of conflict it was. And so just being able to talk with each other about, you know, situations we come across, you know, things like the character development program, kind of lessons learned in how to, you know, get our messages across to, you know, the people who are listening. It's been a very interesting process, but I think I still rely pretty heavily on members of the unit I was in. So I mentioned that platoon sergeant earlier, Shane Stocker, you know, I still talk to him regularly and ask him advice, and he'll still, you know, talk to me like I'm a day one, you know, private in the U.S. Army. And I'm like, okay, well, I understand now. Thank you.
That's interesting. Is he very much older than you?
Yeah, he's a few years older than me, so he's probably around 40. Actually, he's in the same state as me now, in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And so he's been promoted a few times and has a whole brigade out there. So pretty interesting.
That raises an interesting question. He obviously stayed in. You've chosen to leave mm-hmm. the military. Why did you choose to leave, or had you ever considered a full career in the military?
I did. So actually, when I enlisted, I have pretty much every intention of making it a 20-year career. That's what I wanted to do with my life. But after 9 November 2007, something kind of changed for me. I talk about this a lot, especially with people who I served with, but things just weren't quite the same. I couldn't get my mine, you know, 100% into my mission and what I was doing. And I was approaching a spot or time in my military career that I was going to be in a leadership position and have soldiers of my own that would rely on me to make, you know, the right decisions, and their families would rely on me to bring their loved ones home. And I knew that if I couldn't, you know, put my mind 100% into what I was doing, and, you know, it wasn't fair to them, it wasn't fair to the mission, and it wasn't fair to their family. So it was time for me to get out.
Okay, so just to clarify, boys and girls, that date was the date of Kyle's Medal of Honor action, not the date that he was awarded his Medal of Honor. So it was a result of the circumstances of that day, not the Medal of Honor.
Yes.
In turn, however, so you were no longer in the service when you were awarded the medal. Is that correct?
No. So what had happened was after that date, you know, 9 November 2007, I mentioned the date of action. I went back to the United States for some funerals of the guys that were killed in action that day. And when I came back, you know, my chain of command, you know, basically the guy in charge, said, you know, they're considering you for the Medal of Honor. And I was like, okay, well, you know, that means nothing to me after that day. You know, award is just an award. And so, you know, over the next few years, it was kind of rumblings on, oh, you know, it's still in the process of being approved, so on and so forth. But I kind of told myself, well, if it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, that's fine too. So, you know, I got out of the military. I'd already been accepted to, you know, UNC Charlotte. Mm-hmm. I earned my degree in finance and actually got my first job December 31st of 2013. And I was, you know, talking to my girlfriend, now my wife, that I was like, you know, everything's kind of working out. I just graduated college, just got my first real job. And I was like, you know, I bet I hear something about the award. And sure enough, about a week and a half later, you know, somebody from the Pentagon called me and told me about it. And so it was an interesting process. But yeah, all in all, about 6.5 years later.
Wow, that's a long time. It's a huge process. And they don't hand these out easily. So it speaks well that the review ended up where it did. Some boys and girls have asked how you think your life might be different because you have the Medal of Honor now.
Well, it's different for sure, because I mean, otherwise I don't think I'd be in the position I am sitting here talking with you about, you know, that day and the character development program in general. But, you know, it's definitely been a process. You know, you go from somebody who, you know, I was just a regular veteran, like tens of thousands that get out every year, you know, go to school, get a job, and live my life. And then everything kind of takes a turn, and really the plans you thought you had, you know, aren't really achievable anymore. And you're kind of put on a different path. But, you know, I'd say the opportunities and just the experiences I've had since, you know, being awarded the Medal of Honor has been great. I mean, I get to go around, you know, talk with kids in programs just like this, and, you know, I get to go just really be a part of the veteran community and help where I can. And that's really what I'm passionate about.
That's terrific that you have those opportunities. But what is interesting, I think, is that you are the same person now that you were the day before they put that medal around your neck. But mm-hmm. The difference is the way people perceive you because of that medal. And I think that speaks volumes to the nature of the Medal of Honor, that you were so deserving of that, and it speaks about your character. And that's why Kyle is here talking with us today. And I think it's pretty consistent. I like that you used the phrase generations of Medal of Honor recipients, because many boys and girls may not know this, but before the first medal was awarded for actions in the War on Terror, and that was Sal Giunta's award, in 2000, I'm not sure, the 2010,
yeah.
Right. A Medal of Honor had not been awarded since the Vietnam War, which ended in the early 1970s. So there were a few that had been revised and awarded from previous actions, but there was not a current day award. So the difference in the age between those previous generations is actually like three generations, mm-hmm. because those Vietnam guys are the age of your grandparents.
Yep, absolutely.
So there was a big gap in there. So they really are a different generation. But we talk about Medal of Honor recipients more in generations in terms of the conflict that they were involved in. So we have the group that you're with, that's the War on Terror. And then before that, we had the Vietnam group. And then back to Korea and World War II, World War I. There were some conflicts in between where a few medals were awarded, but mm-hmm. it's a different kind of process. Yeah. But I think it's great that you guys can all work together and occasionally party together.
Yeah.
So, all right. Do we have another question from the boys and girls from Royal High School?
Hi, my name's Faith, and my question is, which teacher that you have had the most profound effect on you, and what made them stand out?
That's a very good question. So I'll be the first to admit, in high school, I was less than a, I guess, stellar student. So, I didn't get into college the first time around, but second time, I think it was probably really not a specific professor in college, but the whole kind of staff that was in the Veteran Resource Center, just because, you know, they understood I'm coming from, you know, a completely different world, and now I'm on a college campus and, you know, kind of lost, you know. And so really just being able to have a whole group of people, you know, kind of there to help guide me through the college process, it was absolutely something I won't forget. And, you know, I still talk to a few of them here and there, and I visited them a couple months ago. So it's pretty interesting.
Now, we have students on today. We have a lot of elementary school students. So clear up to some of you who are probably pretty close to graduating from high school. The I want to point out to the elementary school students that it won't be very long at all. It seems like it now, but it won't be very long at all before you're making decisions like that about going to college and such. Did you have any idea at the time that you went into the service that you would be coming back out and going right into college?
No, I didn't. So like I said earlier, I had every intention of, you know, serving a full 20 years and retiring out. But after I decided that it was time to get out, I started making my plan, and that was to go to college, because you have, you know, when you serve your country, you know, you get the post 9/11 GI Bill, and that basically pays for your college education. And so I knew that was a tremendous resource, and so I decided to utilize it. I'm glad I did, because, you know, it's pretty hard to find a path in your chosen field. You know, for me, it was finance. I wanted to be involved in it. And really, to work at a big bank, there are not much opportunity unless you have a college degree.
Oh, definitely. It's, if nothing else, there's certainly a ceiling that you'll hit if you don't have a college degree that you can't go past. The difference, though, between the person you were at 18 when you graduated from high school and the person that you were when you got out of the Army several years later, how do you think that the 18-year-old high school graduate Kyle would have done in college if you had gone straight there compared to what you did when you got out several years later?
I wouldn't have done good, that's for sure. So I think a part of that is just I didn't really recognize the value that education had at the time, because my career path that I was probably on, if I didn't go in the service, didn't really require one. But I guess when I served and I kind of understood the importance of working hard and, you know, kind of accomplishing your own goals, whatever they may be, when I got into a university setting, it wasn't too bad. I mean, it was the same kind of thing. You know, in the military, you're taught, you know, here's a manual for what you have to learn about this weapon system or being a medic or whatever it may be. And you have, you know, 1 week to learn it. I mean, well, college is kind of like that as well. You know, here's the subject, learn it, you have a test on it next week. And so it was pretty adaptable.
You really knocked out college, though, didn't you? How long did it take you to graduate?
I'm just shy of 3 years.
Just shy of 3 years. Yeah. Excellent. Okay. Sorry. Royal, you got another question for us here at Royal High School?
Hi, my name's Caitlin. And my question is, how did being in the military help you prepare for your career?
So I kind of mentioned it a little bit earlier, just about kind of like I always talk with, you know, other veterans and stuff, kind of the bag of skills you leave the military with. And so that's things like, you know, showing up on time, you know, being prepared, you know, learning how to effectively communicate with your peers, and then kind of the work ethic I mentioned earlier, just really everything that was trained into me in basic training and throughout my time in the Army, it was pretty easy to translate. It was just, you know, hey, I don't have to be you know, yelled at and doing push-ups anymore now I'm here in the corporate workplace. So, and I did a lot of push-ups because I, you wouldn't know, but I have a smart mouth and that got me in trouble, but yeah.
I bet though that doing things like push-ups and learning to follow orders probably also saved your life more than once.
Yeah. A little discipline forced into me. You know?
Yes. Do we have another question from Royal High School?
Hi, my name is Dane. And my question is, what can civilians do to support and show respect for active military members and veterans?
Well, that's a great question. And so what I always say to that is there's no right answer. And what I mean by that is, you know, 5 or so years ago, the thing that dominated TV was Wounded Warrior Project. You know, give them money to help some wounded veterans and stuff like that. Well, now, like, what I'm kind of seeing in the whole kind of veteran community is that Wounded Warrior Project sort of era, if you want to call it, is coming to an end. So what I mean by that is the conflicts are dying down. You know, we're no longer in Iraq, Afghanistan's starting to wind down. We're getting less wounded warriors and we're getting more people kind of reintegrating into society, right? So at that point, there's still kind of this military civilian divide that, you know, military, you know, veterans feel they come from, you know, a different world. And then, you know, it can be viewed the same way for civilians looking at veterans. I think the best way is to do something that you find passionate about, like you find passion in supporting. So that might be a community event. It could be, you know, giving to a local, you know, veteran nonprofit, if that is, or just participating, you know, activities at the local VA, whatever it may be. I think anything at your community level is a great cause, because there's nothing, you know, these veterans and transitioning service members want more than to just find a place that's their new base. So their next step in coming back to a place that they feel like home.
Great question. I see we have a lot of high schools on from various places across the country. I want to give a quick shout out to Mr. Robbins' class at Steel Canyon, who was with us online last month. And also we've had schools sign on from New York, Tennessee, North Carolina, Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Wisconsin, Iowa, and the United Kingdom. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, you've got some a big audience here today. I don't know exactly what our number is, but it's pretty good. And we've also, the state of Washington keeps popping up on the corner of our screen here. I'm going to switch ahead a little bit to something, because this is a question I don't want to miss. I want to go back to questions from the students. But somebody wrote in ahead of time, as a parent, and you're a new parent, and a new parent of a beautiful little girl, Sophia, and who is far too young still to take any of your advice because she's only 9 months old. But some of our students would like to know what kind of advice you would like to give your child.
Oh, boy. That's a loaded question.
Well, it's a good time to answer it because she's too young to give you grief over it.
Yeah, exactly. So, one of the things, actually, so my wife and I have been thinking about, you know, where we want to live and what do we want to do with, you know, education for our daughter? Do we want to do like preschool, you know, that whole topic of discussion. And, you know, we were talking about colleges and, you know, kind of where she might end up going. And kind of the one thing we've realized at being in our current careers, you know, things that we may not find interesting or you know, kind of disappointing in what we do on a day-to-day basis, we just want her to find something that she's passionate about. So, you know, if that means she wants to go to school and pursue a professional career, or maybe she wants to get a certificate in something, you know, maybe a trade, whatever it may be, I just want her to be able to do something that she's passionate about, because, you know, if you go to work every day and you love what you do, it's not really like you're working. It's more you're chasing your passion. And if that's something that she could find, I think that would be absolutely amazing.
That is a great answer to that question. I'd like at this point then to go from there, chasing your passion, to back to when you originally went into the service, you were chasing your passion at the time. You wanted to go into the service and you wanted to serve. And one of the, we talk about military service, obviously serving our country, but a great deal of what our military does that usually does not get the most press is service in the places where we go. So I think that Royal High School has some questions about Afghanistan and the culture there and how you interacted with the people. Royal, do you have a question about that that you wanted to offer?
Hi, my name is Jake, and my question for you is that while you were overseas, what surprised you the most about Afghani culture?
What surprised me the most about the culture, I think, was probably their connection to history. So what I mean by that is, you know, we had a very hard time establishing relationships with communities because really everything's kind of in the area we were in, everything's kind of separated by valleys. So you have massive peaks of, you know, the Hindu Kush mountains that separate, basically isolate communities from each other. And, you know, they'll hold on to something, you know, a grudge against maybe another community, you know, a couple miles away, because 250 years ago, you know, somebody, you know, stole some property from the other village. And it's like, in actually adding to that, we went into one village that Americans had never been in before, and their thing against trusting us was the fact that they got betrayed, like their ancestors got betrayed by Alexander the Great. And so they still hold on to that over, you know, centuries. And, you know, it's still something that they're passionate about. And I guess, you know, for a civilization that, you know, is very third world, you know, it's a little easier to hold on to that because, you know, there's the world around you is changing a lot less. But just being able to actually witness somebody saying that, it was just, you know, kind of surprising.
Well, that's really interesting that they have grudges that are older than our entire national history.
Yeah.
And in California, which is where I'm from, buildings don't last that long. What with earthquakes and all that, and we tear them down after 50 years. So that's a really interesting observation. Anything else about the culture that you noticed? Were you there at all involved in any of the humanitarian efforts, or because you were an infantryman, were you straight into the battle?
No. So, well, it's interesting you bring that up because where we were was so remote. I mean, it was only accessible by helicopter. So there were no roads that really went there unless it was roads connecting existing villages. But kind of our primary mission about that whole deployment was to build relationships with the community. So we understood that as an outside force, you know, we're going to be looked at as a foreign invader, but really we wanted to rid the Taliban because they had control of, you know, each local economy. You know, they stole from families and, you know, entire communities lose what they have. And so being able to, you know, sit down on a weekly basis with what's called, I guess, a Shura meeting. Mm-hmm. And so that's like the equivalent of like a local city council or PTA meeting and stuff like that, where we discuss issues. You know, we kind of really involve ourselves early on and be like, okay, so we're here, we can offer you, you know, some type of assistance. You know, we're really not here to hurt you, to hurt your families, whatever. Maybe we want, you know, the people that are bad, we want to get them out of here. And so, you know, we did a lot of humanitarian work, food distribution, medical attention, whatever it really the community needed that we were able to provide, that's what we were there for.
Did you get much in the way of training about interacting with the Afghan locals before you went over there?
So yes, in you're offered some sort of basic language course that you can kind of take to learn to speak the local language, which was Pashtun where we were. But the problem is how I mentioned those isolated communities, each of them speaks a slightly different dialect. So even if you knew, you know, the word for hello in one village, it's not going to mean the same thing in the other. So definitely we had interpreters with us at all times that was able to kind of help us translate and bridge that sort of communication divide that was there.
I would think with all those isolated villages that that would be an ongoing perpetual sort of thing if they don't have much communication amongst themselves.
Yeah, it was definitely probably one of the hardest challenges.
Did you ever find that after you had perhaps befriended the people in one village, that then there was antagonism as you went to another village because you had befriended the village, or was it all just because you were outsiders from the country overall?
So I would say that good news was didn't really travel fast, but if there was any sort of bad news, then it definitely traveled fast.
Oh, interesting.
So for example, the local Taliban in one village that we were in, they had rigged a trap for us. So it was a sort of like a trailside bomb. So when we go by, you know, we trip the fuse and it blows up and they accomplish their goal. Well, you know, when we went by, it didn't go off. There's some kids playing on the trail, you know, later on, and they ended up being killed by that same thing. And so the locals placed the blame on us. It wasn't us, but, you know, once that news distributes around the valley, then, you know, we're the bad guys. And so, unfortunately, you know, for every two steps forward you make with your progress and your mission, there's always one step back. And those types of events, unfortunately, were common and definitely, you know, poised a challenge for us. So.
I think that's the kind of phrase that you hear with the phrase collateral damage, which is not very precise because it's a euphemism.
Yeah.
It's a kind of a blank term that covers up its real meaning. When it's horrible that happened. That I'm glad it didn't happen to you guys, but it's also horrible that it happened to the kids. And that is the nature of war, and it's the nature of war ever after, because they're going to be finding those things over there for years. Royal, could we have another question from you?
Hello, my name is Isabella. And I was wondering, how did day-to-day life there differ from here? And what do you appreciate most now being back?
Okay, that's good. Good question. So day-to-day life when you're deployed, I mean, it can, back then, this is like 2007, we were continually expanding kind of our footprint of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. So we were in a very remote part. I'd say I never take for granted a hot shower. And what I mean by that is there's like a good, I think, 3 or 4 month stretch where I didn't have, like, it's going to gross some of you out, but a shower. So, I mean, you have like water bottles and stuff like that. You can, you know, wash your hair with it, but, you know, we didn't have running water that was, you know, able to use for that. So yeah, I definitely don't ever take a hot shower for granted or a cheeseburger, because during that same time, we just ate those MREs, which are meals ready to eat. And, you know, they're designed to last for like 10 years or something. So, I mean, they're not appetizing, but that was, you know, we ate, you know, morning, noon, and night for about 4 months. And so, yeah, a hot meal and a hot shower, I don't ever take for granted.
Basic things.
Basic
that
things.
You probably
Basic
had taken things. For granted yep. for a long time before that. And it's not like you were walking down paved streets and not getting dirty. I mean, what was the temperature and the basic living conditions like?
Yeah, so our first base we were at was actually on the side of a hill at about 7,500 feet in elevation. So It was, you know, right on the side of a mountain. And we got there right at the beginning of the summer. And so, you know, you're walking around the mountains, you have, you know, at least 100 pounds of gear that you're carrying, and it's about 100 degrees out. And so it was pretty rough climate, pretty rough climate.
And hot.
Yeah, yeah.
Really hot.
Well, so, yeah. So one thing you got to understand too is, you know, everywhere you go, you have to have all your protective gear on. So that's, you know, your Kevlar vest, you know, your Kevlar helmet, and, you know, all your eye protection and everything like that. So, and long sleeves, pants, everything. So even if it's a short movement in 100 degree heat, it hurts. That's for sure.
And I would point out to our students who are listening, think about your own size, your own height and weight. When my daughter was 16, she had an opportunity to go out with a SWAT team for an observation day, and they dressed her up in all their protective, their SWAT gear. And she probably weighed 120 pounds at the time. And she said, "Mom, when they got all the gear on me, I couldn't pick up my feet. It was so much weight from the added gear that she couldn't actually couldn't physically move, and you were stomping up and down mountains with all that extra gear.
Yeah, it was not fun.
Wow. It speaks to the physical conditioning and the importance of that.
So I thought I was in like really good shape before we got there, because I mean, for months and months, all you're doing is training for deployment. And then the one thing you can't really train for is altitude. And so no matter how in shape you were when you got off from sea level to 7,500 feet and you're trying to walk around, it was just, that was the worst for about 2 weeks. It was just,
yeah, it'll
misery.
Actually make you sick. Not misery. Only does it, is it hard to breathe, but it'll make you sick to your stomach. Yep. Do we have another question from the students at Royal?
My name is Sophia. How are you able to handle the transition from being just a soldier to now being a recipient?
So lucky for me, I kind of had a little bit of transition time. So what I mean by that is, you know, I got out of the Army in 2011, went to school, and had a couple of years to kind of, you know, readjust to normal life before receiving the medal. But I'd say, even although I've been a recipient for, well, I'm, I think 2014, right? Yeah, so about 4 years now.
Right.
It's still an adjustment, and it's still something I'm not entirely comfortable with, and I'll use an example as my neighbors. You know, I've lived in my neighborhood for about going on 4 years now, so slightly, you know, just a few months after being awarded the medal, and not a single one of my neighbors has any idea I'm a recipient. And that's just because that's the type of, you know, life I live. I'm just a regular guy, you know, nothing special. There's just a day I get was recognized for, that's all.
Okay. Do we have another question from Royal High School?
You guys got some good ones.
Hi, my name is Andrew. Which character trait or traits do you value most and why?
I'd say integrity is one of the ones that, and really there's an acronym in the Army, and it's kind of the, you know, things that you live by, and it's, the acronym's leadership, and it's loyalty, duty, respect, selfless service, honor, integrity, and personal courage. And kind of, I think integrity is the one that, you know, really sticks out to me. And because I've, and you'll encounter this, and I'm sure you already have, you know, at a time when you knew somebody needed to do the right thing, or you were expected to do the right thing, and maybe you chose, you know, not to, or your friends chose not to. You know, I've been involved with a lot of experiences where I've seen that in the Army, in, at a leadership level and as a at a peer level. And it's just something that when I see somebody own what they do, and, you know, if it's a mistake, take ownership, learn from it, address it, move on. And to me, that's just one of the things I feel probably the most passionate about, and something I try to always express in my day to day.
That is a great way to put that for all our students out there. Our students of all ages, own what you do. When I was talking with Kyle before we started, I have sons about Kyle's age. And when my boys were little, they had a friend around the corner from our house who they always got into trouble with. They just, when the three boys were out playing, I knew there would be trouble, and you oftentimes a trip to the doctor as well. And one time I had the three of them lined up on the driveway scolding them, and Scotty, who was the biggest of the troublemakers of them, had messed up something, and his dad was a Marine. And when I called Scott on it, Scott stood up and said, "Mrs. Metcalf, I am so sorry. I was wrong. I shouldn't have done that. I sincerely apologize." And he apologized to the kids he did it to. I was floored. He was about 10 years old. It's never too soon to own what you do. Great example. Do we have another question from the students at Royal?
Hi, my name's Dane, and I have another question. What was it like at the White House, and what was the medal ceremony like?
So, the White House was a great experience, just because the amount of history that's there. You know, there's, you wouldn't know it, you know, when you see it on TV, there's specific rooms that they show, you know, like the East Room, stuff like that, depending on what kind of ceremony is there, the Rose Garden, the Oval Office, whatever it may be. But, you know, there's rooms throughout, and if you go on like a White House tour, you can see it. But you know, there's one room where it shows like the dining set for each president that's been there. And so it's kind of interesting to see, like, you know, the plates they used, and every piece of artwork that's there has a story too. Some of them are insanely valuable pieces, but, you know, if you get shown around by one of the kind of curators in the White House, you know, they can tell where every little table came from and, you know, what period it was from. It's actually very interesting. I'll kind of tell you a funny story about the age of the White House. You know, my wife was still my girlfriend back then, but she came with me to the ceremony. And the way the process works is, although you're, you know, the president calls you and tells you you're being awarded the Medal of Honor, it's not actually official until he signs it. And that's kind of a thing where he brings you into the Oval Office with your family, and then he'll actually open up the award and he'll sign it, and you get to talk, you know, a little bit. And I say talk, but he's the one who talks and you just kind of, you know, sure. but it was like 3 or 4 minutes before you're supposed to go in there and meet him. And my wife goes, I need to use the restroom. I need to go. And so they're like, okay, well, restroom's right there. It's right next to the office. You'll be fine. Well, she goes in and I hear, you know, kind of some, the doorknob is jingling and, you know, you hear some noise, and then she's beating on the door because in the heat of the day, like the actual wood in the White House, like on the door, is swelled, and it swelled the door shut.
Oh my gosh.
You know, and it's the one that's like right outside, you know, then President Obama's office. So, you know, like probably some pretty important people have gotten stuck in there before, but you know, it's funny. She had all her makeup done, and then she, you know, by the time we got her out, she was all flustered and hairs everywhere.
Oh no.
But it was a funny experience. But I think probably the best part about the whole ceremony and everything was I was able to invite about 100 people. And so that was, you know, friends and family of the guys that were killed that day, as well as everybody who I'd served with on that deployment. So we hadn't seen some of each other for 6 years at that point. And so being able to kind of get the whole, you know, unit back together and hang out for a few days was pretty amazing.
Well, that's not a very big room that they hold that in. So I'm impressed that you got to invite that many people. That's terrific. Very good. Okay. Do we have another? We're getting close to the end of our time here. We'll do a few more questions, but I want to make sure that I get everything from Royal. Royal, do you have another question for us? I should say for Kyle specifically.
Hi, my name's Caitlin. My other question is, what can I do today to honor your service?
Well, you don't have to honor my service at all. You know, I volunteered to serve, and that's something, you know, I'm proud of. I'd say if you wanted to honor anything, you can honor the guys that were, you know, kind of killed in action on that date of 9 November 2007. So if you want to learn their names and learn about that day in general, I would encourage you to go to that, you know, usarmy.mil and look up the battlescape and really kind of read through that if you're interested in learning those guys' stories, because each one of them, you know, had a special place in our military family, and, you know, we always think about them.
Thank you for answering that. A Medal of Honor doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's the only one of the medals for which soldier, sailor, airman, and marine are put in for by the people who are in the trenches with them or on the hillside, as the case may be. So that was a very, very good question, and thank you for that answer. Mm-hmm. Okay. We have just a few minutes left. One teacher asked, do you have any particular point that you'd like to share with our students that they should take away with them from this interview? Do you have any particular words of wisdom?
Yeah, so people talk a lot about, you know, serving their country like I chose to do. But there's one thing I'd like people to understand is that service can come in any real shape or form. So that could be anything is like serving your community, you know, serving your, you know, fellow member of your neighborhood, whatever it may be. I'd say that just encouraging just service in general is a positive thing. And like, so right now I tend to involve myself with veteran causes because that's what I believe in. You know, that's what something I'm passionate about. I have a connection with it. But that doesn't mean that, you know, that's what everybody has to do. Find something that you're passionate about, something that you care about, and get involved in it. You know, give back, because, you know, really, regardless of where we come from, we're all in the United States of America, we're all enjoying freedom. We all have a lot to be thankful for, and there's a lot of people that aren't as fortunate as we are. And so anytime we can give back and kind of serve each other and build that sense of community, I think it's a positive thing.
So I had the privilege of interviewing you 4 years ago, right after you got your Medal of Honor. And in fact, 5 days from now is the anniversary of your award.
Yeah.
How about that? So we're coming up on that pretty fast. At the time, I asked how your life had changed with the medal. And you said to me, I will never forget this. I've been around the Medal of Honor my whole life. You said, you took hold of that medal and you said, I kind of like to be anonymous. Mm-hmm. And this has ruined that. You are definitely not anonymous anymore. And but one of the things that many people in this world are terrified of is public speaking. And now you've got an audience out here of several hundred people today. We can't see most of you. We can only see Royal High School. But you do public speaking on a regular basis.
I do.
And one of your Medal of Honor colleagues said, life does not become significant until you start to live outside your comfort zone. And I think when you're telling these students to go do service, I think that fits, doesn't it, with the comfort zone?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Because you've certainly been outside. The Medal of Honor kicked you out of your comfort zone, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. And I remember when I was in high school, I hated public speaking. And I'm still not a fan of it, but I mean, I guess I can limp my way through it pretty good now. But if you're ever, you know, thinking about that, the thing that's always helped me is, you know, especially I'm never the one who's first speaking. Like, as long as I'm not number one, like the first person on a cold crowd, then I'm okay. But that's always what I think about. Well, he just was up here, so if he can do it, I can do it. And that's kind of what's gotten me through it. So if you ever have to do your class presentations, be like, well, the person before me did it, so, you know, I'll do it. Most of the people aren't paying attention, so they won't even be listening to what I'm saying anyways. Yeah, so I see a bunch of people shaking their heads. So like,
a lot of grins from Royal High School on that one. Okay, in fact, let's kick it back to Royal and see if you have anything that you want to wrap up with here, Royal High School.
Hi, I'm Sophia. On behalf of Royal High School, we want to say thank you so much for being able to talk to us and answer our questions. Also, thank you so much for your service.
Yeah, it's an honor to serve. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you all our viewers today for watching. We're about to wrap up here. We have a couple of things that we need to take care of as far as business is concerned. We thank you for joining us, first of all, because without an audience, we'd be talking to ourselves, which I'm always happy to do, but it's better with an audience. So I hope that you'll take away a lot from this experience today. Teachers, you can get your CE certificate for this Ed webinar. If you're the directions are there on the screen. If you're a member, it will be posted to your homepage. If you logged in today, you can look at the directions here on how to get it. And those of you who are watching this archived in the future have to go on and take a quiz to indicate your participation. So do follow up and get your GE, your continuing education credit for that. For the Congressional Medal of Honor Foundation, when Kyle was talking about the CDP, that was the Character Development Program. We have lessons available based on stories of Medal of Honor recipients. And the program is entirely free. It can be incorporated into your existing curriculum. It fits in language arts, social studies, across the curriculum very much. And that's all available free. You can learn more about Medal of Honor recipients there, and we will host teacher trainings in your area. So contact us via www.themedalofhonor.com. We are also doing an Excellence in Character Education Award. That goes to teachers who have been using the Character Development Program for 6 months or more. And we are currently accepting the applications for that, but we're getting close to the deadline on that. So if you're interested, go take a look. The prize is significant, $5,000, but more importantly, an opportunity to meet with Medal of Honor recipients in person. Our next webinar will be Tuesday, June 12th. A lot of you will be out of school by then. In fact, some of you are probably out of school now, but on Tuesday, June 12th, we will be interviewing Roger Donlan, Medal of Honor recipient from Vietnam, and I would strongly encourage you to join us for that. If you can't make it on the actual day, then you might log on later and watch it, or encourage either teachers use it or students encourage your teachers to use it next fall. That wraps us up. There's a Medal of Honor. I'm sorry, EdWeb has Medal of Honor community, and you can join the community free where you've got access to all these things. So go ahead and to the EdWeb website there and log on to that. I think that takes care of us for the day. Right. Thank you again, Kyle, for being with us. And everybody have a great day.
All right. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this EdWeb podcast. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.